Good morning. It's good to be here this morning, and certainly want to wish you welcome, those of you who are visiting with us. We have several visitors among us this morning, some who are passing through and some from the area, and we're glad that you're here with us, and count you as our honored guest this morning. If you have time to stay afterwards just for a few minutes so that we might get to know you, we would ask you to do that so we can descend upon you and find out who you are and why you're here. And we're glad you're here this morning and thankful that you could be here to worship the Lord with us this morning. The last couple of times I've spoken on Sunday morning, and I preach about once a month, we have engaged in the topic of evidences for what we believe. And I have used as a pattern my experiences that I've had in my efforts to teach the gospel in several trips that I have made to China. And so we began a couple of months ago where we often begin when we start teaching in China, and that is with the Chinese language study. Many of you saw that study, and I've given it a couple of times here. And in this study, we have evidence of Bible accounts from the first 11 chapters of the Bible that are in the characters of the ancient written language of the Chinese nation. And so that language was written down, began to be written many, many years before the Bible stories were ever written down. And so that is evidence that these ancient Chinese people were perhaps descendants directly from those who came from the Tower of Babel and the dispersion of the people after the Tower of Babel. And so we see there evidence of things that we couldn't see otherwise. And so when we show this slideshow to those in China, it often piques their curiosity because they see something from their own culture that possibly reflects these ancient accounts that are recorded in the Bible. The next step when we're teaching, and especially if we're dealing with those who have been brought up as atheists in post-communist revolution China, is to show them that it is reasonable to believe in a God, any God, quite frankly. And we often face that challenge in our country today because, again, it's been science has been pitted against religion as reasonable. Science is reasonable because it's based on things that we can see and based on things that we've experienced and can do experiments on, versus religion, which is unreasonable because it's simply based on our whims or our beliefs or things that we want to believe in. And so what we did last time I spoke was we looked at the evidence in creation itself that points to a creator or a designer. And of course, that's not contrary to the Scriptures, because the Scriptures even say that the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows forth His handiwork. So once a belief or belief in the reasonableness of God, the next question to be addressed then is, which God? If it's reasonable to believe that there is a God, that there is someone greater out there, that there is someone that is beyond us that created all of this, then which God should we believe in? The religious world, especially worldwide, is filled with many different gods. There's the God of Islam. There are the gods of the Hindus in China. It's the God Buddha and ancestor worship. And so why would we choose one particular God over another? Why the God of the Bible? What is unique about the God of the Bible? What is it about our Bible that convinces us it is truth as opposed to other religious writings? Now, with that little teaser, we're not going to address that topic directly this morning, because I want to address one thing before we get to that. And there's another issue that is often encountered when we try to teach the Bible here, even in the United States, that I want us to examine this morning. In times past, Stacy and I have had several opportunities to teach some people. I think we've been blacklisted now. They don't come to our house anymore. Teach those, study with some young men who are from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, oftentimes called the Mormon Church. And they profess to believe in Jesus. They profess to believe in the Bible. And they profess to teach from the Bible. But they insist that the true and final revelation of God is in the Book of Mormon. And so Stacy and I, when we study with them, often have a strategy. We tell them, we're glad to study with you. We'd love to study with you. But we're not going to look at the Book of Mormon until you can convince me from the Bible that we need something else. Because we believe that the Bible teaches itself to be complete and everything that we need to know about life and godliness. Why would we need something else in addition to that? And so oftentimes they'll agree to that. All right, let's go to the Bible and see that we need something else. And so we'll begin to point out to them some contradictions between the Bible and their Book of Mormon, or the Bible and the things that they practice as Mormons. Oftentimes starting with the fact that these 19 and 20-year-old young men are calling themselves elders. And we'll go to 1 Timothy 3 and point to that passage in Titus chapter 1 and say the qualifications for elders. First off, elder, the word means older man. Secondly, it says must be the husband of one wife and have believing children. And then the argument always comes back to us, well, the Bible is corrupted. The Bible is corrupted. And therefore, only the Book of Mormon is trustworthy. And so if there's any contradiction, and we don't believe there is any, but if there is any contradiction, that's because the Bible has been corrupted. Well, I have to say, that's really a valid question to ask. Is the Bible, what we have in front of us today, really reliable? Are the Scriptures reliable? Can we put trust in what we have in front of us? Can we be confident that what we have in our hands today is what was actually written down 2,000 years ago and even earlier than that? Can we be certain that what was written back then was even accurate? And so when we ask the question, are the Scriptures reliable, there are three main issues that need to be addressed. The first issue is historical accuracy. Is what was written actually what happened? The second issue is transmission accuracy. In other words, is what we have today what was actually written down 2,000 years ago? Is that what was originally recorded? Has it been transmitted to us in a reasonable and reliable fashion? And then the third question, or the third issue to be addressed, is translation accuracy. Is what we read in our language today, is what we read in English, an accurate reflection of what was originally written in a different language? And so I want to take a look at each one of these issues in a little bit more detail and ask the question, are the Scriptures reliable? Can we rely on what we have in our Bibles, in our hands today, as what was written down and as accurately representing what went on 2,000 years ago? And I want to focus primarily on the New Testament. Because again, that's primary our focus for who we are as God's people, New Covenant people. But much of this will apply to the Old Testament. So let's take a look then at historical accuracy. When we look at historical accuracy, there are a couple of central issues that come into play to determine whether or not a writing is historically accurate. And the first issue is time frame. Time frame. How long after the events took place were those things written down? How long after the events took place were those events written down for us to have and read later on? And then secondly is the bias of the writers. Were the writers biased toward a particular position? And if so, did it affect what they wrote? Did they write simply out of their own bias and not accurately depict what went on? And so let's look at some considerations for these central issues. When it comes to time frame, when we look at the Scriptures, the earliest documents were written within 12 to 18 years of the life of Christ. Paul began writing his letters sometime in the mid-40s. We don't know an exact date. Some people put it as early as maybe 43. Others maybe as late as 48 A.D. Christ died sometime around 30 to 33, A.D. 30 to 33. So we're talking at a minimum 12 years and at a maximum 18 years that these first documents were written down, Paul's letters. And there's pretty good evidence that some of those things that Paul wrote in his letters were things that had already been written down before, and Paul incorporated those into his letters. So that really takes that time frame back even closer than that 12 to 18 years. For instance, in Philippians chapter 2, when Paul begins in verse 5, "Let this mind be in you which was also in Christ Jesus," many scholars believe that this section that follows is kind of a formula that had been written down before and that Paul was simply quoting that back. "Who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men." That was something that had been written down even long before Paul had ever put it in that letter. And so again, that would take that time frame back to much closer to the time that the actual events took place. And when we look at historical writings, really, that's a very short time frame. Much of what we read in history was written down much later than the events actually took place. So that's a pretty close time frame when we look at it. So this, and secondly, when we think about the time frame, a lot of people will say, well, everything that's written down about Jesus was simply legend. Yeah, maybe Jesus existed, if they'll give you that. But the truth is that this was kind of like Paul Bunyan. You know, that legend developed around Jesus, and these people wanted us to believe something, and so they developed these legends and made him to be something that he never was or never even claimed to be. But the truth is, legend takes generations to develop, especially when there are hostile eyewitnesses still around. There were many people who would have been glad to disprove the things that were written down in the Scriptures. There were many Jews who believed that following Jesus was something that would be worthy of putting to death, Saul of Tarsus being one of those. And there were many of those who were still around when these documents came out who could have proven, if there were proof out there, that these were lies and legends. In fact, that's exactly what Peter calls upon in Acts chapter 2 when he preaches that first New Testament gospel sermon, and he preaches that Jesus is raised from the dead. What does he say? He said, "You know where David's grave is. If you want to find out if David is still there, go dig it up. You'll see that his bones are still there. Over here we have an empty tomb." And so he knew that eyewitnesses were there who could point to David and his grave and his remains, and there are eyewitnesses who could point to the tomb where Jesus was buried and show that it was empty. And those hostile eyewitnesses were still around when these documents were written. Secondly, when we think about the bias of the writers, you're right. They were writing what they knew, but what they believed also. But the truth is, these writers lost their lives for their beliefs. And you may go, well, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people throughout the centuries have lost their lives over their beliefs. They've gone to their graves because of what they believe. The men who flew those planes into the towers on 9/11 died for what they believed in. Right? They believed that they were going to get 70 virgins in heaven with God if they flew those planes into those towers. But here's the difference. They believed that not based on any firsthand knowledge of anything. The apostles had firsthand knowledge whether or not Jesus was who he said he was. They had firsthand knowledge whether or not Jesus said the things he said. They had firsthand knowledge whether or not that tomb was empty. They had firsthand knowledge of his appearances to them. And so if they died for that truth, or let's look at it this way, if that had all been a lie, they would have known that it was a lie. And so is it reasonable to believe that 12 out of 12 would have kept their mouths shut about a lie and be tortured and put to death for propping that lie up? That's not reasonable at all. Those 12 men knew, and there were many other witnesses who knew too, who suffered death for this. But those 12 men knew whether or not Jesus had been raised from the dead. And if it was a lie, it would be an amazing thing that all 12 of them would have gone to their deaths without backing out. I know I would have gone, "Oh, wait a minute. You're going to do what to me? Yeah, that was a farce. And so when we look at the historical accuracy of the Scriptures, it stands the test. And we can go back and look at other things that point to the historical accuracy. You can look at Luke's accounts and Luke and Acts and look at all the historical markers that he points to that are simply setting the stage for the details that are going on. And we can go back and look at the archaeology that shows that Luke was accurate in all of those. We can trust the historical accuracy of the Scriptures. So the second issue then is transmission accuracy. Do we have today an accurate account of what was written down 2,000 years ago? And again, there are a couple of central issues when it comes to transmission accuracy. One is time frame from the originals. Okay, we don't have any of the original documents. We don't have any letters that were written in Paul's hand or Paul's secretary, whoever wrote them down. We don't have those originals. We have nothing original from the New Testament. And that's not unusual. When you look at ancient documents, most of those we don't have the originals from. But what we have are documents that were copied from those originals. And so when we talk about transmission accuracy, the issue is how long from those originals are those earliest documents that we have. And the second central issue is the number of extant documents. How many documents are in existence that agree with one another, that point back to those original documents? So again, let's look at some considerations of that. When we talk about ancient documents, ancient historical writings, if you can get within 500 or 600 years of the original, you're doing pretty well. There are extant documents from the New Testament that date to with 100 years of the original. We have some scraps from the Gospel of John that are from the 2nd century. John was likely written in late 1st century. So those scraps of the Gospel of John are within 100 years of John's writing those Gospels. That's really close in time when it comes to ancient historical documents. We have full versions of the Bible from the 3rd century. That's within 300 years of all of these documents being written. Those are full versions, and we have lots of versions from the 2nd and 3rd, lots of documents from the 2nd and 3rd century. Documents and versions differ in that the versions are the whole thing. If you have the whole New Testament, that's a version. One of the most famous ones is the one called Sinaiticus. It was found at Sinai, and it's a full version of the New Testament. Documents are simply scraps that are found, and those documents can be scraps of maybe just a few verses up to documents that contain all of Paul's letters or one or two of the Gospels. We have versions, full versions, that are within a couple of hundred years. Documents we have much earlier than that even. The second consideration is that there are thousands of those documents still available, scattered throughout museums throughout the world. There are thousands of documents from the New Testament that are still available to us today. And if we didn't have those, what we have are the writings of the Church Fathers. The writings of the Church Fathers. The Church Fathers are those who wrote theological treatises about Christ and about the New Testament within the first 3 centuries after Jesus' death. Irenaeus, Athanasius, Polycarp, a lot of those who wrote these things down. They were writing theologically. They have discovered that you can put together pretty much the whole New Testament simply by pulling quotes from these church fathers. That they were quoting the New Testament in their writings, and you could put together almost the whole New Testament just pulling out those quotes. And so it's amazing the documentary evidence that we have that backs up the New Testament Scriptures. And I want to take a look at it just to give you some examples of ancient history. Tacitus was a Roman historian, and he wrote the Annals of Imperial Rome. No historian today disputes the accuracy of his accounts. And what we have is one document that dates about 730 years after the original writing, and we have another document that dates about 1,000 years after that original writing. That's all we have. That's all we have as far as ancient documents that reflect what he wrote. We don't have his original writings. We have these two documents. Josephus. Josephus was someone who was a Jewish historian who was concurrent, lived about the same time that Jesus and Paul did, maybe a little bit younger, and documented the histories. One of his most famous ones is the Jewish War, which documented the history of all of the things that went on around the fall of Jerusalem. And again, historians believe that those documents, that history that we have today is very reliable. We have one document that dates to about 300 years after Josephus wrote. And then we have about 9 documents that are within 900 years of the time he wrote that. So again, just a few documents that are out there. Homer's Iliad, again, not a historical piece, it's fiction, but nobody again disputes that what we have today of Homer is what he actually wrote thousands of years ago. And what we have are about 650 scraps that are within about 1,000 years of when the originals were written. Now look at what we have for the New Testament. Within 200 to 300 years of the original documents being written, we have 306, and this I got these statistics from several years ago, 306 documents that are within 200 to 300 years of the originals. And we have more than 5,000 that are within 400 to 900 years of the original documents. So we have literally thousands of documents, 1,000 times more documents than what we have for any of these others that people consider to be historically accurate. It's amazing, the documentary evidence for the Bible. There is nothing like it in ancient writings as far as documentary evidence to back it up. And when you compare those documents, a lot of times you'll notice in your Bible you've got little footnotes that say, this is worded differently, or this is a little bit different in certain documents. If you were to pull all of those out, it's still less than 1% of the New Testament that is disputed in those documentary differences, those differences in those different documents. Less than 1%, and there's not a single doctrine, not a single teaching that you would go back and go, well, I don't know if this teaching is in question now because of this documentary difference. It's amazing the documentary evidence that we have. The third issue then that we look at is translation accuracy. How accurate are the translations that we have? Can we trust our English translations that they're close to what the original documents were? And there are two central issues here also. One of them is the number of intermediate languages. And I want to handle these each as I bring them up. Number of intermediate languages. In other words, the Bible was written initially in Hebrew, in the Old Testament, Greek, and the New Testament. So, is the English translation we have today based on a German translation that is a translation of the French, that is a translation of the Coptic, that is a translation of the Syriac, that is a translation of the Greek? You see what I mean? It would be seven languages removed from the original language. Is that what we have today? No, we do not. We have the original Greek, and our English translations almost always are taken from the original Greek. Now, there have been some English translations that have been taken from the Latin, because the established language of the Catholic Church was Latin, and so they translated the Greek into Latin, and that's what it was read in for centuries. And so there are a few translations that take it from the Latin, but most of our modern translations today are taken from the Greek and the Hebrew. They go directly back to the original language. So there's no issue as far as intermediate languages. Now, obviously, and we'll talk about this in a minute, there are issues going from Hebrew to English and Greek to English, but we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Then the second issue is, central issue, is how many other documents are in the same language. And that's important because you may go to the New Testament and find a Greek word in that New Testament that's used only once or twice. And you may be scratching your head, well, how do we translate this? We only see this word once or twice in the New Testament. That doesn't give us much of an idea of what this word really means. Well, the beauty of it is it's written in Koine Greek, which now is a dead language. We certainly still have Greek today, but it's not the same as Koine Greek. If you've ever gotten a hold of the original King James Version from 1611, if you ever have the original version, I've got a copy of it if you want to look at it, you start reading it and you go, what? It's English. But the spellings are different, the wording's a little bit different. You know, you would have to slow down when you're reading it to go, okay, I think I understand this. Because languages change. That was 400 years ago that was written, 1611. And so language changes a little bit. So the modern Greek today is not the same as the Koine Greek was, but Koine Greek was in a time period. Now it was a bit of a transitional period, but there are a lot of documents that were written about around that time that we still have today. A lot of historical documents in the Koine Greek and the Classic Greek. The Koine Greek is a little bit different from the Classic, but a lot of documents. It was a proliferation of writing in that time. And so we have a lot of other documents that we can go to when we find a word that's unique in the New Testament or not used very often. We can go to other documents and see, oh, here's how that word was used in that time frame. And so that helps us out with those translations. God approves of translations. Now you may look at that and go, well, how in the world do you know that? That's a kind of a weird statement to make. When the New Testament writers, inspired New Testament writers, quoted the Old Testament, they didn't quote the Hebrew Scriptures. What they quoted was the Septuagint. The Septuagint was the Greek translation that came into being about 200 BC of the Old Testament Scriptures. As the Jews were scattered, and as Greek culture began to take over that region, there were a lot of Jews who grew up not knowing the Hebrew language because they were not in the area of Jerusalem. They were scattered throughout the Roman Empire. They didn't know the Hebrew language. All they knew was Greek because that's what they were brought up learning. And so the Hebrew Scriptures were translated into the Greek language. And when the New Testament writers are quoting from the Old Testament, they're quoting the Septuagint. They're quoting the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. And so for us to say that anything that's been translated, God can't approve of that, is not a good idea. However, we do need to consider some things when it comes to translations. Every translation contains interpretation. Let that sink in for a minute. Every translation contains interpretation. No language translates directly from one to another. Ideas, concepts, phrases that appear in one language don't translate smoothly into another language. And all the times that I've gone to visit China, I wish I had taken pictures of all the signs that are translated into English because they're hilarious. You know, the signs that tell you about, you know, warnings about drop-offs or not to go into this area or those signs. They're hilarious because it's Chinese translated into English and it's not a smooth translation. And sometimes it really just is funny. And so languages are like that. So every translation is going to incur a little bit of interpretation because you're having to interpret those phrases. You're going to have to interpret those usages that are not common to our language. And therefore, no translation is going to be 100% perfect. No translation is 100% perfect. And so what we need to do is look for those translations that are best trying to translate word for word, or at the very least, idea for idea. We don't want paraphrases. We don't want things that really kind of start interpreting a whole lot more than what is simply there on the page. And so there are translations that we can use that do that. And so that's why I always suggest when you're studying, use several translations. If a passage doesn't seem clear to you or maybe have some nuances that you may think be there, look at another English translation. And again, look at translations. Don't look at paraphrases, none of that. But those translations, different translations are going to give you a sense of what that is about. And if you can learn a little bit of the original language or at least use some resources that take you back to the original language, that's even better. So what's the so what of what we've looked at today? We can conclude that the Bible is historically accurate because of the fact that those documents were written in such an early time frame before, after the events took place. The fact that the apostles lost their lives over the truth that they were fighting for and knew about. And we have seen through archaeological evidence the accuracy of those things that are written in the Scriptures. We can be confident about the transmission issues because of the comparison to other ancient documents. There just is no comparison when it comes to those issues. And also translation accuracy. But let's look at a couple of quick things before we conclude. God is just. The Scriptures tell us God is just. Secondly, God is powerful. God created the universe by speaking it into existence. God raised Jesus from the dead. God is powerful. Thirdly, God is love. God loves us, loves you and me. He cares about us, wants what's best for us, and He desires to spend eternity with each and every one of us. As Joe read earlier from the Scriptures, we have a standard that will judge us, and that standard is the words of Christ. If God is just and God is powerful and God loves us so much that He desires to spend eternity with us, can He not preserve His Word in such a way that we know what He demands of us, what He requires of us? I absolutely believe that. But we don't have to just believe it. We can look at the evidence before us. And we can see that what we have in front of us is accurate based on the evidence that's been put before us. It's a good question. A question that bears a thoughtful response to when somebody says, is the Bible reliable? Can we trust what's in there? Can we believe it? Has it been corrupted? And I think we can answer confidently, it is reliable. And it has not been corrupted. And what we have is what God would desire us to have. Paul tells us that the gospel is the power of God to salvation. And the gospel is what we have written in this book. And it is our obedience to the gospel, our faith in Jesus, our obedience to the gospel that determines where we spend eternity. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian and you're not sure what that means or what you need to do, come talk to us and we'll sit down with this book that God has given to us and we'll study those things with you. But if you know what you need to do and you've come to believe based on hearing His Word and are ready to confess Him and repent, change your life, and be buried with Him in baptism that you may be raised to walk in newness of life, I encourage you to come forward as we stand to sing our hymn of invitation.